This episode is brought to you by Intellum. You know Intellum, we've had them on the show before. And if you've been listening to this podcast, you know that customer education leads to retention and revenue. So the Intellum platform gives you everything you need to educate your customers, partners, and employees on the products and services you sell. They've got a great platform. They've got Evolve as an authoring tool. And with Intellum, put it all together, you can deliver highly personalized and engaging learning experiences, give your customers a single destination for all their learning needs, and create and manage a wide range of content. So check them out today at try.intellum.com/CELABS. That's CELABS.
And welcome to CLAB, the Customer Education Lab, where we explore how to build customer education programs, experiment with new approaches, and exterminate the myths and bad advice that stops growth. Dendon's Tracks. I am Dave Darrington.
And I'm Old Hot Dog Shirt. That's my name, Adam Evermescu, Old Hot Dog Shirt. Great to be with you today.
Okay, Old Hot Dog Shirt. God, that is great. Oh, where does... Shannon.
I'm angling. Dave wanted me to do outtakes, so we're doing outtakes. Okay, and let's we are here. Nope, we're doing it live. We are here today with Shannon Howard from Intellum.
Hi.
Hi, Shannon.
Thanks for having me. Excited to chat.
Yeah, it's going
to
be great.
Excited to chat with you. And we have a really good reason to be chatting today. Not that we don't always have a good reason to be chatting, but I think we have a spectacular reason to be chatting today, which is that we have on our hands a fresh new Forrester report, courtesy of Intellum. Yeah, hot off the press. And so listeners may know that we have a bit of a tradition of doing report season, which is a holiday that we have manufactured around the time where we look at all the reports that we didn't look at earlier in the year and talk about them together. But we don't often do is actually like get them as they're coming out, do the analysis. And the other thing that we don't usually do is actually have someone who has that deep behind the scenes insight about how the report was put together, what insights you were looking for. So Shannon, I'm so glad you're here because you can really be our guide and our listeners guide in some ways to all of the insights in the report.
Yeah, I'm excited. This was very fun to work on and the Forrester team's great. So excited to dig into the data.
Cool. You know, before we get started though, we have another tradition that we do, which is the International Day Of, which I guess we need to share our screen to show what's going on today. I'll do that for us. And here we go. Let's see. Okay, we get to pick our favorite. It is Learn About Composting Day, everybody. That's amazing.
There you go.
What have you learned about composting today?
Well, we have to do it in Seattle all the time. So there's a green container for it that you put in there and it gets really yucky. I don't know. Mm-hmm. It feels good. Although I have to separate a lot of my trash and garbage and compost, I feel very, very sustainable here in Seattle. How about you guys?
I tried to learn about composting, but I was just garbage at it.
That's a great way to start out, composting. Okay. It's also Oak Apple Day, the end of Middle Ages.
Little light compost humor. Cool. So, Shannon. Mm-hmm. Let's dig ourselves out of this compost pile and talk about the report. So I would love maybe to start with a little bit of context on like give us the how, the why. Like mm-hmm. we know that you've done this report before in I think 2019 was the last time. So now we're 5 years out from that report and we're doing an update. But yeah, maybe give us a quick behind the scenes on this report and how it was put together.
Sure. Yeah. So the big, I guess, impetus is this is like old data, right? So everybody kind of loved the 2019 report. And then the question that we got asked all the time is, when are you doing another one? Or can we get updated data? So that was kind of the motivation to do a refresh version of the report originally in 2019. And I was not here in 2019 to work on the report. So I can only report historical fact. But the idea being, you know, people it takes time to prove the value of your customer education program, right? And we're always wondering, what are other people doing? How are they proving the value and the impact? And then also, can we point to data points? Like, how can I make the business case for customer education? How are other companies using it? And so to be able to provide some objective data points through a, you know, third-party organization like Forrester on how businesses are using customer education and the value that they're deriving from it. And so I think this report is unique. Forrester does two types of reports. They do their thought leadership reports, where they're kind of asking questions about an industry, putting together a more topical report. And then they do their total economic impact report, which is usually interviewing 3, 4, 5 of your customers to look at the average ROI and then payback period for your product or service. This was more on that payback period and the ROI of, or the total economic impact of customer education. So not a product or service, but actually that role in that field of customer education. So I think unique in that it combines that thought leadership aspect with the total economic impact and for customer education. So, you know, product agnostic, you could use this to make a case for customer education.
That's great. We need this kind of data and this kind of summary and analysis for this industry because, and Adam, I've seen, you know, we've all been out there on the so-called circuit and talking and thinking and, you know, being our thought laggardness, as Adam you'd like to say. But to be honest, we talk about ROI a lot and that kind of analysis that, okay, what are you really getting out of this over time is extremely important to show the validity of this craft, this function. So that's exceptional.
Yeah. I'm curious, maybe like, cause we looked at the 2019 report before, also looking at the more recent one. Cause we wanted a little bit of a trip down memory lane, but maybe more importantly, we wanted to see what has actually, you know, shifted since that point in time. Right. Cause now we're talking about pre-COVID. It was, you know, just a very different era for SaaS, for customer education, for all of our respective industries. Were there certain things deliberately that you wanted to look for this time that maybe weren't in the report last time? Because you called out the total economic impact, which is super cool, but like I noticed a few shifts as well.
Sure. So one, and I think you noted this in your notes, was around more of the demographic. And so we asked to focus a little bit more above 100 employees. And part of that just being, if you have under 100 employees, you're in early startup mode and probably don't have too much in terms of formal customer education. So to make it a little bit more kind of apples to apples and people who are really trying to do more formal customer education to focus more on that demographic. We also included some, so we'll talk about the rise of in-app guides. That wasn't an option in 2019. That wasn't one of the choices. And so we added in some things that we felt we're missing in terms of, if you think of your content mix, different modalities, it's just not there in 2019. Mm-hmm. And then you definitely had, none of us saw COVID coming maybe. So that obviously changes your content mix, right? So some of it is interesting where, you know, we just all had to adapt and shift things. And so that also impacts some of those trends. And then at the end, we added some questions around AI because everybody's talking about it. And so we wanted to understand, are people using it? What are you using it for? What's your timeline to implement? Especially, I've been hosting a lot of roundtables. It always comes up in every conversation of who's using it. What are you using it for? And then a lot of people saying, okay, I hear all these companies using AI. I'm stuck in legal and security land, right? I can't get anything approved. So, you know, what is that implementation timeline for people? Just to kind of like understand, where are we at?
Great.
Yeah, that makes sense. And really, really looking forward to digging into those in a little bit more detail, because you're right. Some of these were things that weren't really on anyone's radar in 2019. We certainly weren't really talking about AI the way that we do now. I don't think anyone knew what an LLM was. Well, some people did, but most of us didn't. And also, though, I really want to hang on to that point. We're probably going to need to remind ourselves when we try to do comparisons between the 2019 and the 2024 report is that it's not completely apples to apples in the sense that we were dealing with a slightly different demographic than skewed slightly towards more towards smaller organizations. And also the representation even of where these folks were reporting looks like it's shifted a little bit. So like in the 2019 report, I noticed there was a lot more representation from sales and marketing. And in this one, it's diversified a little bit more. There's more representation from customer success, more from support, but maybe one of the most meaningful shifts of all is that larger representation of people who actually identify as being in a customer education organization, which is a good sign.
It's a really good sign. Okay. How do we break this down? Shall we jump into the different the different categories of the report? You know, we have like five or six sections here that we can go down. And then, Adam, like you're saying, we could probably just go jump back and forth as needed to talk about the comparison between 2019, because this is really important. This kind of etching or, you know, ratcheting forward and then coming back and say, what does the data say? Coming back again, what does the data say? And reconciling all these reports is really helping us triangulate this, the impact of what we do.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. So yeah, where should we start? Should we start with some of these major takeaways and then we can kind of drill into some of the individual topics?
Yeah, let's break down the major takeaways and then come in from that and then we'll focus out, we'll laser out, or it's not laser, blow out.
whatever someone does to go out of something in a dramatic fashion, we will do that thing. We'll
exit
find a verb for
left.
It. Yeah, yeah. There we go. We will back into the bush. So 2019, just to summarize a couple of major takeaways, like one takeaway from that report was that 90% of orgs that were surveyed had some sort of positive return on their investment in customer education, which is super cool.
Right.
We're gonna see that theme pop up again, just articulated differently.
Yeah.
Number two is that organizations had increased their spending already on customer education compared to the last 2 years, right? So there was like a 2017 benchmark, and then they were being interviewed in 2019, mm-hmm. and they'd already increased their spending 80%. And they predicted that they were going to double their spending in the next 2 years. So we're going to look and see if they actually doubled their spending in 2021. Spoiler alert, they didn't. But it's interesting to see the trend. And then the other thing that was interesting to see is that when programs are formalized, and we got to come back to this idea, right? Formalized versus more mm-hmm. ad hoc customer education programs. Formalized programs drove better results. So there was a 6.2% increase in bottom line revenue, 7.4% increase in retention, 6.1% decrease in support costs, right? And you add those up and you take the costs of all of those things, and that actually adds up to a pretty significant ROI for the business if you can attribute that to customer education.
Right.
But on the other side of that, penetration was low. So we saw that 28% of their customers weren't even offered training and 47% of the customers hadn't utilized education offerings. So I think like those are the major themes that I would pull out of 2019. So I think revisiting those as we go through, let's see what's changed. So Dave, you want to start talking about some of the major themes from 2024?
Yeah, let's start breaking into that. To begin with, and I'm going to ask you to validate this, Shannon, for us. We're talking about, let's see, 300 education decision makers was the cohort for this? Is that accurate?
That is accurate. Yeah.
Break it. That's a decent N. That's a decent number for statistical reasons. So, all right, let's break down. We have 300 people we interviewed across. Now we've ratcheted up a little bit into the market. We shifted up market. Like Adam, you said, there were more small companies back in 2019, now mid-market, now enterprise, better represented in this for us. And I think that's good. I mean, we're already seeing the formalism that's starting to be layered in for a lot of these teams.
Well, that's a sampling thing, right? Like
yeah.
if Forrester chose last time to interview smaller teams and found that like they were seeing immature mm-hmm. companies, then this time you would think by shifting a little bit up market and talking to say like fewer organizations of fewer than 100 employees where you wouldn't expect to see a formal customer education team built, like you kind of know what the results are going to look like if you don't have mm-hmm. a formal customer education program. So
right. it can be inconsistent.
It seems to me like that's like one of the motivations for like looking at now like slightly larger companies. Shannon, like was there mm-hmm. an intention behind the sampling there?
Yeah, more just looking at companies that have already probably made an investment or might have someone more dedicated, right? Because when you're in that under 100 employees startup phase, a lot of it's ad hoc. A lot of it's yep. probably just mm-hmm. random people around the company. So people who are starting to maybe think more about implementing customer education had the resources to start doing that.
Yeah, you're not having your like one accidental CSM or support person that's sort of doing customer education on the side and maybe has no background in it. So they're kind of like figuring it out from first principles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, the play on that, the next observation here is that we saw a significant demographic change. We've already kind of talked about in department, right? Mm-hmm. So what CS being, okay, wait. In 2019, comparatively, marketing and sales are like 60%. That's a lot. And CS only 11, actual CE departments were only, so again, playing on what you were saying, their actual CE formalized departments are only 17%. Now, that's the largest, which at 25% is respectable. Marketing is down to 22. You know, we've moved it around, but again, Adam, what you were saying before is important. And Shannon, you're playing off of this and saying now we have that formalized person or team that's doing the work.
Mm-hmm.
Super important on that.
Let's
see. We also have to consider a lot of respondents in the 2019 were in a lower maturity, right?
I mean, I think even this time, we still have like quite a few low maturity.
That's interesting.
Teams, right? Well, because even though we've shifted, like, let's say slightly upmarket, it's not an entirely dramatic shift. It's not like now we're only looking at companies of, you know, like 500 plus employees. We're just looking at fewer.
We're just going the next
that are 100 and below. So while proportionally, I'm sure we're seeing more companies that have now made the investment in more formalized practices, there's a mix. And as we know, companies mm-hmm. can actually get quite large before they invest in formal customer education if they aren't really like building it into their DNA to start with. So like, for instance, one of the things that we saw later in the report is that 50% of them said when they were asked what they were going to do in the future, they said they were planning to implement a dedicated customer education platform, which means, Shannon, correct me if I'm wrong, that like they probably don't even have an LMS. And if we think about that, like not having an LMS is a pretty good sign that you have a relatively immature program.
Mm-hmm. So I was thinking about that. I think some of it is depending on your content mix. If you have more of those in-app guides and things that maybe aren't administered through an LMS. And we also see, especially with enterprise companies, building their own version of a learning management system, right? So they've done mm-hmm. a lot of that in-house. HubSpot did that. Salesforce did that. They're both doing it pretty well. But you have a lot of enterprise companies that have tried to build their own thing where they might now be realizing, okay, maybe we don't want a dedicated development team responsible for that. It's not actually profitable. If you think about core competencies and kind of context competencies, it's not really a core competency for most organizations. Yeah.
Okay, that's a really good point. So if they say they're planning to dedicate or they're planning to implement a dedicated customer education platform, that might not mean they're launching their first LMS or their first customer education platform. It might mean that they're doing some sort of replatforming.
Mm-hmm. Or even not repurposing an employee LMS would be probably the other one. We see a lot of people trying to repurpose their employee, like internal LMS for external purposes. And if they're not purpose-built for that, it can be limiting.
Interesting. Okay. So that's interesting in its own right then, right? Because like we saw this theme over the past several years where at least there was a thought that a lot of programs were going to do more consolidation of their mm-hmm. tech stack and were going to move towards more all-in-one platforms that could support organizational and enterprise and customer education. But it sounds like maybe still like they're putting some emphasis on saying, regardless of what tooling I use, what tech stack I use, I have to find something that first and foremost meets my needs for customer education so I can actually run this as a business.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, just to play off of that, I think that's really important because, I mean, Adam, you're out there like I am. I'm talking to a lot of people and I'm seeing a pause in a lot of cases where people say, we're not quite ready for that. We're probably going to fail if we go and jump into an LMS type solution too. And I've seen more people, not ones that I've said this to, bring that back up. We need to have some content. We need to have a plan. Mm-hmm. That's a good change too, because that's a mental maturity or the maturity that's involved in thinking about our craft.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
That's definitely a prerequisite for us. A successful customer already has content and a content strategy. And if you don't have that, you're probably not ready to implement an LMS, and we'd be doing you a disservice really to sign you up for one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a good way to think about it.
That's a healthy consulting approach. And we'll see that, right? We'll see that when it comes down to like how we think some of these respondents are approaching customer education, especially in like the what you call like the low success mm-hmm. programs, where it seems like they're still kind of in box checking mode and not necessarily investing a whole lot in content strategy or quality or things like that.
That's right.
But what we do know is that they're spending more money. So in between 2017 and 2019, we saw already, what was it? I think I said an 80% increase. Mm-hmm. And at the time, they said that within the next 2 years, they were going to double their spending. And that didn't really happen. But it's still up about 40% from that time. If I read those numbers right.
Middle of that would have been COVID, you know? So I don't know that anybody's spending was doubling in any area. It's probably being pulled back a lot.
So COVID is the big X factor in the middle. I guess COVID and now the recent economic downturns, right? Like we're not in zero interest rate environment anymore. So both of those probably inflected spending quite a bit.
Yeah, it's been an interesting mm-hmm. ride over the last 5 years as well.
So I'm impressed, like, because COVID could have cut one of two ways, right? Either COVID could have accelerated everyone's investment in online learning and forced them to change the types of investments that they make. But on the other hand, like, from a spending perspective, it might have been that several of those respondents were pretty deeply committed to bulky in-person programs with training centers that are actually quite expensive for them. So even if they made big investments in online learning, they might have still cut their total spend, or at least kept it relatively neutral and just reallocated it.
Mm-hmm.
True.
Yeah. So I think it's still impressive in like when you consider COVID now being in a much more cost-controlled environment, the fact that we still have this like 40% inflection, like that's significant. That tells me that there's still a pretty gradual but significant investment being made in customer education.
Definitely. One other insight I think that's really cool here is that there is a shift away from the traditional workshops. Adam, when you were talking about how some companies may have been having a really big investment in that in-person environment, now we're getting away from the traditional workshops and certifications. We should speak about that a little bit more. The other way of saying it is that we're getting away from the old school. You can see my air quotes on the audio here. The old school kind of thinking is you have to have a formal certification. You have to do all these different things. Maybe that's not such the case anymore. And we're seeing that happen.
Well, there was a quote even in the 2019 report, right? To the extent of, I think it was like a knowledge manager said, nobody has the time, interest, or money to sit in a week-long training class anymore. So we mm-hmm. have to change our approach. And bear in mind, this is pre-COVID, right? Like, so the seedlings for this were already there. Mm-hmm. But Shannon, you brought up something interesting in the pre-show that I think probably bears repeating here, which is like, just because we're seeing new modalities show up now as like the top modalities being used by different organizations, it doesn't mean that the old ones have completely disappeared. Like, some of this is, like, you were even saying this on air like a moment ago, right? Like, some of this is you introduce new survey options, so those are going to get selected, and that might be more reflective of what people are using. Do you want to say a little bit more about that?
Sure. Yeah, definitely saw a decrease in workshops, but again, makes sense if we're not doing live trainings, like in person, especially during COVID, and whether that's because of travel and budget costs, but also just not wanting to be around people, you know? And on the certification front, a slight decrease in like percentage of respondents who are offering or you know, prioritizing certifications, but definitely an increase in more of that just-in-time learning, right? Because I think about some of the software that I use, and I don't have time to take a certification in, you know, if I have a tech stack of 15 different products, I don't need to be certified in all of them. I don't care to be certified in all of them. Sometimes I just need to know enough to move along. And there might be someone else on the team who does go through that certification because that's kind of their primary tool. And so I think we're also looking at more of how do we meet those diverse learner needs, right? Not everybody is going to be a Salesforce admin. I just need to know the basics, right? So how do I serve that up to people? And I think when we think about content mix moving beyond that, and then also more asynchronous learning, because we have people in different time zones. And I can't tell you the number of times people can't make something last minute because a meeting gets scheduled, you know, or something pops up. And now you don't have people attending the workshop that they were originally planning to attend. So something for them to consume on their own time.
Those are really, really good points. And I think a lot of the selling points in general that, when we talk about async and just-in-time learning, it's a little bit about meeting the customer where they are, but I think also recognizing that the average customer's preferences and expectations have changed. The default is no longer, I'm going to go to a class, I'm going to do, a week-long workshop, I'm going to take a certification. And I was thinking about this when I saw those stats as well, because I think maybe we're seeing two additional things to what you said, because I agree with what you just said, Shannon. I think what we also might be seeing is, number one, the representation of where customer education lives and operates is continuing to move beyond its the core of tech services, right? And if you're talking about these highly complex technical products, those are the ones where the whole mental model of having long workshops and needing technical certifications came from in the first place, right? Like being an Oracle admin or a Salesforce admin or a Microsoft architect or something like that, right? This is not true of a lot of products, not just because people don't have the time to commit, like you said, but because the products just don't have that same technical depth or risk associated with them. So as more types of companies take on customer education programs, they might not need that same rigor. And the second thing that I was thinking about, and I've noticed this more anecdotally than anything, is that I think the fever has finally broken on companies thinking that they need certification just as the default thing. And I think part of that is because people are realizing how expensive it is to do a formal certification, but also because I think customer education leaders are getting better at consulting around that and saying oh, you think you want a certification? Well, why don't we walk through what actually you're hoping to get out of that? And then we can design a program that's a better fit for the needs that you just expressed, instead of just defaulting to let's make a cert.
Yeah. To riff on that, one other thing I'm seeing as I'm engaging with a lot of different and kind of in a consulting motion is that same thing where companies are saying, I see in this. This brings back home the async thing, Shannon, you were talking about it, and Adam, the experiential side of how do I get through all of this monolithic material? And companies are saying, can I spread this out? Can I do it more over time? Or can I make a program that has these engagement points where I can go and learn a little every week and meet with somebody if I need to? Mm-hmm. So that's starting to take more of a customer success in motion, everboarding type approach rather than a one and done where you get in and just say, okay, we're going to do it all and you have to be certified and they're getting it. That's the emergence of more badging, that small bite stuff is really helping. It's easier to get that and say, I got something. And then you develop from there.
Mm-hmm.
Cool.
You want to talk about the benefits a little bit? That was another takeaway.
Yeah. Shannon, why don't you lead with these? Let's talk about the benefits that you found out. What are the problems? These are really cool.
Yeah. So
give the good news.
Yes. Okay. So we talked about in 2019, 90% of respondents said that they had a positive return on their investment. And I will add the caveat, I don't have access to the raw data from the 2019 report. So I can't actually dig into whether we did this the same way. So this time around, 86% said yes, positive ROI on customer education, with an additional 10% saying that they had at the very least broken even. And so the way you see that in the report is a 96% experiencing a positive return. And I love that the analyst said, Shannon, I don't want you to look at it like it's a 4 percentage point drop, right? And again, I don't have the raw data to see if we kind of phrase this the same way. He said, if you think about the value of having it versus not, right? So for that 10% that's breaking even, if you think about the impact of having versus not having, and I know Chris LaDolce said this on a podcast recently, if you ask people sometimes not just the positive ROI, but what would be the impact of not having HubSpot Academy, you know, that can be powerful too. So just having customer education as part of that whole product solution, people are saying, so now we can say roughly 96% are experiencing some kind of positive business impact from having customer education, which is really awesome.
It's exceptional.
Yeah. And like, I think another, maybe another contextual point around this, like it's not a 4% drop is, if you think again about the change in population and the change maybe overall in maturity of programs, is that, you know, ROI, the denominator of ROI is how much you spent, right, to be able to get that return. And if in 2019 you had a higher proportion of immature programs who were spending, let's say, like little to nothing on their programs, well, then getting ROI on your little to nothing is pretty dang easy. Mm-hmm. Whereas now, if we're starting to see overall more investment in customer education, which I think is what some of the numbers later in the report bear out, is that like investment overall in customer education has increased quite a bit, and for good reasons, strategic reasons, just like you called out. Well, then achieving even like break even on that is going to be a little bit tougher.
Yeah.
But if you're doing that through the context of trying to move the needle for your business, then like that still tells us that there's mm-hmm. momentum around like why people are using it strategically, even if that's theoretically coming at the expense of an ROI number, which we don't know the exact methodology for.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I was going to ask more about that. And I mean, yeah, we don't know exactly, but kind of like anecdotally, at least, what are we seeing? How are we measuring that positive return? Is it, oh, well, like we've associated it or been able to attribute it to revenue or churn or some other customer success driven, business driven metric, as opposed to what, you know, like I think we still need to get our methodology down pat and say, these are the drivers. And then the calculus behind that is the harder part, because you're seeing, but okay. The thing I wanted to say to this is that it takes a while to build a function and get output or get a result from it. So you mm-hmm. can't just expect to build a customer education function and 1 month later have results. It's going to take 3, 6, 10, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that. So when you look at the benefits, and I think that's a thing that can be hard too, right? And then you end up with the whole, it depends, you know, because are you trying to move the needle on in-product adoption and customer engagement and retention, or are you doing support ticket deflection and you can measure the cost of a support ticket and how much that deflection saves you? We also saw, and this might've been actually something we added in around people using education in the marketing and sales process to increase win rates and decrease the length of the sales cycle, right? Mm-hmm. So you can also look at that you're getting revenue in the door faster, you're winning at a higher rate. And so if you're able to tie education to those numbers, but again, like just depends on what are the business outcomes that you're trying to drive? Are there multiple? And then how are you measuring those, right? But to Adam, your point around more consulting, well, what is the outcome that you're looking to drive? You know, I could build a certification and try to tie it to something else, but would probably make more sense and be more effective to work backward.
Yeah. All right. Let's get into the challenges though. Like what are the things that people are now finding 5 years later that are the current challenges for people in this business function?
So maybe to lead into that, like what we saw in this report seemed like the biggest struggles were around either lack of tools, which I guess is tech stack, lack of technical skills on the team, by which actually, Shannon, maybe you know this, with technical skills, are they talking about like product knowledge of technical products, or are they talking about like the technical skills of customer education, like instructional design as a technical skill? You know?
Good question. It might be interpreted both ways, whether it's about product knowledge or actually being able to, whether it's use the tools and technology in your stack, or as we're talking about AI do people know how to use AI as part of their job, right? There's so many, and that's what I think is so hard on the skill front is there's so many skills that, that you need to really do customer education well. And so, and are we investing, you know, in people's development? Do we give them time and then also resources and budget to go learn how to do their job better?
Yeah, that makes sense. And you're right, could be a blend of it. If the question was phrased that way, then people might actually interpret it both. And you know, it's not that they're that far off either, right? Like if you're in this field, you probably need some combination of product knowledge and craft skills. And from there it went down, right? So there were other, like there was kind of a gradual decline where it was like lack of personnel and then lack of content volume and then lack of knowledge on how to create a program. And then finally, lack of budget. So it's kind of interesting to see it in that order, is that like actually like the budget and the strategy weren't actually the problems per se. It was this much more like functional, tactical, like how do we actually put the right tools in place and how do we give people the right skills to be able to develop this stuff?
Let's also talk about one of the interesting things in the summary here is that we're seeing a lot more vendors as partners. I'm saying that with a dramatic effect, vendors as partners. Mm-hmm. That's kind of exciting to me. That's really, that is really exciting to me to see, because that means, you know, I personally work with a lot of different vendors and I've sensed and seen this. So there's been like a feedback loop as all of us are starting to learn more and we put books out and we put podcasts out and we go to conferences. I'm seeing vendors actually dive into that more, like you, Shannon, and say, oh, I know this and I'm active. And okay, I'm just going to say something that I really like about the work that you do, that you are always looking and learning and active in your role and not just kind of reflecting, right? Not, I mean, just bouncing back what other people say. And that's really refreshing and good to see. It means you understand the craft and the challenges that we're working on. So let's talk more about this as, you know, briefly about what, why has there been a shift? What happened in that?
Yeah, no, I was just going to say like I kind of noticed the same thing. Like I was looking at the 2019 report and they did the same comparison, right? Of high success versus low success teams. And there was an inflection as well with vendors, right? Where the high success programs were using in-house teams like a little bit less than the low success ones were. It was like 60%, 60 something to 70 something. I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, but they were also augmenting themselves much more with agency partners and third parties. So overall it seemed to suggest that even at the time, while companies were still investing in in-house resources, they weren't only investing in in-house resources and were already starting to build those partnerships. So yeah, Shannon, like I'd be curious kind of, yeah, what was the conclusion this time about the relationship with vendors for those high success programs?
Well, what had kind of come to mind to me is you think about how many customers, right? And you all talk about this in terms of finding your tribe, the number of people who are doing customer education and don't have the words for it. And oh my gosh, there's a book. Did you know? You know, they just have no idea. And so then you think about some of these vendors that are working with all these programs who are aware of some of these resources or who have worked with hundreds and or thousands of customers to implement their programs, right? So we've learned what works, what doesn't work, right? Where maybe not everybody's going to tell you that you need content and a content strategy before you buy an LMS, but your LMS vendor can tell you that, right?
Yeah.
And so we're looking at maybe more holistically what we're seeing across customers instead of, you know, one by one. I think can be a reason why some vendors could be more strategic consultative partners because they're seeing a little bit more of a swath of experiences. And then also depending, you know, if they can consult on how to use their platform effectively. So we stood up a new branch at Intellum called Advisory Services. That's more consultative services of, hey, how do you get more out of the platform, right? You have access to this whole suite of tools and maybe you're not leveraging them all effectively. And how can we help you to do that based on what we've seen be successful for other customers? So if you think about, you're able to kind of apply from one place and transfer to another.
Yeah, that's definitely true. That resonates. And I like your point about what we see out in the communities and out in the world of people getting into customer education, that really resonates. I think it's more common now than it was then to actually have a path to figure out, if you can name it, at least if you can name that the thing that you want to do is customer education. Now,
if you can name it,
there's a much richer world of like resources, partnerships, people that you can turn to make that happen. And I think that that's also something that really, like, we've seen vendors do really well, including Intellum and including yourself over the past couple of years, is give people who are in that kind of low information state a path in, and a little bit more of a vision towards, like, what does good look like? What can your crawl, walk, run look like? And we asked, we asked you to ask Forrester a little bit about that correlation, right? Because I thought it was really interesting to see, like, both times, I think, there was the implication by looking at this that having in-house customer education teams is less popular than it has been. Like, I think in the 2019 report, it was that the high success orgs had less in-house resources than the low success orgs did, which seemed paradoxical. And then this time, the finding looked like the number of in-house training teams had declined from what it was in 2019, which you might look at that and you might say, oh, does that mean that everyone is just divesting their customer education teams? And that's one conclusion that you could come to. But, like, Forrester's response, I thought, was interesting. They said that there wasn't really, like, a statistical correlation between having or not having those in-house training teams and lack of personnel. Mm. But if you have a lack of personnel to begin with, then you're more likely to outsource. And for others, the lack of personnel is only going to be realized once they try to do education in-house. So
right. It
kind of cuts both ways. But if you're a low maturity org, you're going to use outsourcing and vendors for something very different than if you're a high success org. A low success org is going to use vendors, and you called this out in the report, right? A low success org is more likely to use a vendor to cut costs. So you're not really developing a strategic partnership. You're just finding someone to go check the box that you might have had an internal team check the box. But if your internal people didn't have any background in customer education and you were just, like, having random people create content, then turning to a random outsourced vendor is not going to accomplish that any better.
That's right.
Which goes back to some of the challenges that we saw in the report, where people were seeing low satisfaction with their training or low quality of their training. Well, of course it's going to be low satisfaction and low quality if nobody knows what they're doing. Versus, like, the high success orgs. And I really like this point. Like, even if they had fewer like percentage of staff in-house doing it, they still had some, but they were making better use of vendors as strategic partners to actually, like, raise their maturity level.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, sorry, that was a rant plus a summary of Forrester. So I've been talking for a long time now.
But it's good.
Yeah. And it reinforces what you all have been saying for years around, you need a strategy, right? You need a strategy before you go and start doing things, right? Before you bring in a vendor, do you know how you want to use them or what you need them for? And I even look at some people who have some really awesome programs that are relatively new. Part of the reason they've been able to be so successful so quickly is because they invested in a strategic partner who had already been down that road before, right? They hired a consultant, a customer education consultant, who had already done the thing. And so I think smart companies are looking at people who have been there and done that and saying, can you help us establish a strategy? Can you help us upskill our team, right? And so they're investing in that mentorship and those resources to help their team be successful, because it is, you need, you know, that combination of business acumen and learning science and technical skills and all these things. It can be hard to find one person with all of that. And you know, on the average budget that you have to start a customer education program.
Yeah.
And do you think that's the context for it? Because, like, the way it's phrased in the report is spicy. I like spice, but, like, it's phrased
always
in-house
like
education teams have dropped in popularity over the past 5 years, organizations are increasingly replacing their in-house education teams with external partners and AI content creation tools. Like, is that what we're seeing on the ground? Are they actually replacing their in-house teams?
I'm pretty sure I pushed on that a little bit because I hate the whole AI will replace you message because I don't think it's going to replace everybody, right? But maybe it can do some of the lower level work that allows you to do higher level thinking work, right? Where, you know, machines can do machine things, humans can do human things. I don't know if it's replacing so much as, right, we want to be smart about how we allocate resources. And so some companies, and you think about, I mean, there's so much that you don't have access to the data of companies that the whole growth at all costs, and they hired a ton of people to, you know, whether it was do the PLG thing or whatever, and did that kind of inflate costs, and then people got like cut back, right? We just don't know how maybe some of those other market factors impacted in-house education team sizes.
I think so we can say, like, we can all agree that team sizes are smaller, and like, I don't know that we can like lay that on the feet of AI or on increased reliance on vendors. Like, maybe those are factors.
I've got a reflection to make here before we transit, because I've been working with a lot, like a very broad diversity of people and seeing like out in the field, in the weeds, and I'm seeing some interesting trends, but they align, Jana and Adam, with the report that we're seeing here, where it's not so much, a lot of rifts have happened. A lot of stuff has happened. COVID happened. People have quit jobs. And now what I'm seeing when I talk to people is that, can we do less, more with less? And this is what I'm trying to get across. A lot of times when I've talked to people who are thinking about building programs, like I was at an event a few weeks ago, and the difference that I've seen in the past few years was before it's, hey, we're going to hire somebody and then they're just going to figure it all out for you. And they may have actually, from a leadership level, made a bunch of decisions like, you're going to buy this platform and you're going to do this thing and this is the way we're going to go. And now I'm seeing less of that and more of a, okay, we've got to get more done, but we've got to get less to do it. Let's use AI in certain ways. And this helps how? Scaling content, helping us refine it, get it to market quicker. Or it's a delivery, a mechanism, like it's distributing it or something like that. And then the people are now a little bit more open. No, I wouldn't say a little bit, a lot more open to saying, I don't know everything. I don't. And I don't have to be afraid of that. And now I know that there is, I remember a couple of weeks ago when I was at an event, somebody came up to me and they were like, you know, the whole finding the others thing about this whole network and community is so important, because someone once said, I didn't know there was anybody out there like me. And now I feel better because I can ask those questions and I can get the help and I don't have to do it all. That's meaningful.
Yeah, I think that's still as true as ever, and kind of goes back to that point about, like, if you can name it, if you know that the thing you're doing is called customer education and there's other people who do it, which is why, like, one of my pet things is always whenever someone comes and tries to rename the industry to something that they think is more accurate or more representative of what we do, I'm like, there is no perfect name. Let's just keep calling ourselves something that other people can identify so that we don't like bifurcate ourselves so that people can find us. But that's not in the report. That's just my soapbox that I stepped onto for a moment. Stepping off that, like, going back to your point, Dave, I agree with you. In my view, at least, like, I don't think that the causal chain goes, we have AI and we have vendors in place, therefore let's reduce the size of our team. Like, that's why I think the way it's phrased is spicy. I think vendors and AI are natural outgrowths of the foregone conclusion that we're not in, Shannon, as you called out, that growth in all costs, zero interest rate era anymore. We've already made conclusions across the business, including customer education, not specifically pointed at customer education, that we have to do more with less. How many companies have done RIFs over the past 3 years? The reality, and I heard this from a very wise SaaS leader, and it resonates with me, the idea that in the past, you could look at the ROI of any given program, right? You could throw a bunch of experiments at the wall. You could make a bunch of investments. You could buy your LMS. You could hire a leader, all of that. And all you really had to do is show that that then had our ROI and you could keep investing in it, right? Yep. But in a cost constrained environment like we're in today, where money's not cheap anymore, it's not about whether something has ROI. It's about if you have the I to begin with to get the R on, right? If you can't actually make an investment in something, then it doesn't matter if it's going to get a return or not. So, like, that's why I think programs are turning more towards strategic partners, vendors, AI as solutions to these, because they've already made the conclusion that they only have this much to invest. And now it's on customer education leaders and customer education programs to say, hey, you know what? We can not just do this more efficiently than other programs that you have in the business right now, but we can do it more effectively, right? We can acquire a lead in a more cost-effective way than marketing can. We can deflect support more effectively than hiring an army of people to answer customer questions, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
And like the results, the key metrics are somewhere else in this report. I actually now don't even remember what section they're in, right? But it's kind of like going in order. It was like where customers were seeing retention, where customers were seeing an effect from education it was like first and foremost
adoption,
retention. Finally found it. Yeah. Improved customer retention. That was 56%. Then increased customer spending, which I'm assuming is like expansion and upsell. That was 37%. And then finally support cost savings, 7%. So when Forrester's doing there, and Shannon, I'm gonna have to punt to you to explain in a moment like how they like what they actually mean when they talk about total economic impact and this idea of $6.71 in annual cash flow per $1 annual spend by year three. But I think it's like pairing that argument that customer education literally actually drives these things on a reasonable time horizon with an argument that we can also do it more effectively than other investments that you can make as a business. And therefore, we are the thing that makes sense to invest in to achieve mm-hmm. those goals. And then let's point customer education at that.
Mm-hmm. There's so much that you just said that I was muted. You couldn't hear my snapping. You don't want to move. Clapping
the whole way. Like, yay, it's great.
Yeah. No, just that idea of, I think we've all been asked, someone said this to me recently, to not always think about like something from a role perspective, but from a broader perspective, right? So when we say doing more with less, the reality is that's true for every team, right? Not just customer education. And so to think about, okay, it's not like we're being targeted so much as everybody is being asked to do more with less. So how do we be creative? And how do we function within these known constraints, right? And we can do that. And how do we, I use the term scrappy, you know, like Dave, you were talking about, we got to be able to create something, improve something before we can get that investment. And I think that's smart. And I would encourage people to do that, to be scrappy and show that you can create value before you ask for money. Because as soon as you ask for money, there's a lot of risk involved in that, right? So right. You start to prove yourself earlier. On the total economic impact part, economist, I am not, math, you know, I'm actually a mirror image twin. I got the creative, the writing, and my sister got the math. So I'm not the math twin. But it's true. She like went to college for math and was a math teacher.
Should we have her on the next episode? Maybe she can like walk us through the math part.
She probably could.
Want to is the other question.
yeah. So the way that I understand that this works, right, is they're looking at a time horizon. Because to your point, you make more of an upfront investment in something and it takes time, right? Dave, you were saying earlier, it can take 3, 6, 10 months to start to see an impact, right? So you might have more of an initial upfront investment before you see that payback. So they're looking at that payback period. How quickly can we see a return on our investment? And then over a 3-year period of time. So they usually, their total economic impact reports look at a 3-year period. So you can look at, okay, over the course of 3 years, what is based on the analysis that we did more in depth of 3, 4, or 5 different people, how much are they earning, right? So we see this 372% ROI with a 7-month payback period. So it's taking maybe 7 months to start to see an ROI, but over the course of 3 years, we're seeing a 372% return on our investment, right? Which, you know, if you're making an investment in something, you usually want to see 3, 4, 5 times the ROI of your investment. So this is like safely, right, on the marketing side of things, we want to see a 3 to 5 time investment on what we put out. So 372% would be a great investment and definitely on par with what a marketing investment, right, when you're talking about how can education drive more qualified leads or a more cost-effective way of driving qualified leads. A 372% ROI would be very appealing.
Yeah. And then if I understand the other part right, like it's saying, so by year three, and by the way, actually, just before going to that, like the probably the important note about this is that this particular part of the study is only taken from the high success organizations, mm-hmm. right? So like to get these returns, you have to be doing it right. You can't just be like throwing content out there and expecting it to perform. And we can go into some of the factors in a moment that the high success orgs were doing that the low success orgs weren't. And it's like, I mean, I guess spoiler alert, it's mostly like data and ops and content strategy, right? But like, let's say you're doing those things. In year three, you can expect to see for every dollar you spend on customer education, it's affecting 671
mm-hmm.
in annual cash flow. Is that right?
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. So they're qualifying here, increased retention, increased spend to a smaller extent, support cost savings, which I actually kind of like that's to a smaller extent.
Why
do you like that?
Because I think there's more of a focus on revenue, right? Through cross-sell, upsell, just more expansion or just driving revenue on the marketing and sales side besides just cost savings. Scope or purview.
Yeah, it gets us closer to revenue for sure. Without having to directly monetize the program even.
Mm-hmm.
That's great. I mean, that's to be able to do that is exceptional. And the fact that you're on one hand, you know, I was just at a big customer success event and they talk so much about this too. Mm-hmm. And for them, when you talk about support, you talk about support is, I think, inclusive of customer success too. It's a little bit different than just answering questions. It's more proactively helping, but the deflection of, you know, having one or two customer ed resources to field all of that and build these functional pieces, it's been hard to actually visualize the impact of all of these things that we do. And the way I look at it is, look, you're building canon of how the platform that you have actually works from a human perspective and helping to reflect that back to those who need it at the right times. So that $6.71 for every dollar spent, that's tremendous. And it's really reflecting on how we can make an impact in this field. It's really great stuff.
Yeah. And it's probably worth like at least briefly dipping into again, like what were the things that the high success programs were doing right to get those types of results. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, just like briefly scrolling down to that area, like some of the key factors for them were access to multiple types of data was the top one. And like we know that data increasingly plays, you know, a bigger role than ever in the success mm-hmm. of a customer education program. And you need to truly have an impact. You need to have your education data hooked up to your business data, right? Yeah. It's more important than ever than to have customer education data flowing into the data warehouse and be able to analyze it on those terms, et cetera, et cetera. Mobile accessibility was called out. I thought that was an interesting one. Like, Shannon, what do you make of mobile accessibility as a high success lever? Does that just suggest that they're making, like, is mobile accessibility a proxy for delivering customer education, like, with better regard to UX?
It's a good question. Could be around UX or just making it accessible, right? And approachable to people where they're at. So I don't, you know, I work at my computer all day and I don't always want to spend additional time learning in front of my computer. And so it'd be great if I could take it on the go. And I think we do see more of an investment in people, like making it so people can learn where they're at or learn where they're from. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you can't do that with every type of like education. It's not all going to be mobile friendly, but more of this focus on, okay, how do we meet learners where they're at rather than getting them to do it the way that we kind of want to do it, right? Whether that's in a workshop in classroom or a formal certification or, you know, in front of a computer.
Yeah. Accessibility is probably a better way of putting it than UX. I think that's a really good point because that also like breaks our old model of customer education equals something that happens in an LMS and it's a SCORM file or it's a certification or it's a classroom, right? Like if we also saw this increase in use of in-app and video and short form and all of these like lighter touch methods, and yeah, of course you'd want that to be mobile friendly as well.
Yeah. You know, I'll do this as briefly as I can, but I was talking with a gentleman from Africa and he was talking about a program where, and to this point that we're explaining, there was no way that this company could have an LMS. It wouldn't work. They were dealing with showing people how to do mobile banking in out of cell phones. You know, all they had is a cell phone. All they could use is a cell phone. So the entire customer education program was built off of the mobile first approach. And it worked. I still want to have this person on to talk about, like it was eye-poppingly amazing on how well the education program worked and how easy it was to access.
Mm. All right, Dixon, come on the show.
Yep.
Cool. Then like two more big ones, I guess, like support and guidance from my organization's platform or software vendor. So I think we drained that topic, but shows that like building that partnership and working with a vendor that is going to teach you something about the space, like is going to increase your probability of success. And I guess it works the other way too, right? Like if you're operating at a higher level of maturity, you're also more likely to use your vendor strategically instead of just using them for cost cutting. We talked about that too.
Right, right.
And then finally, platform and software scalability. So, right, like a lot of this again comes back to it's data and it's ops. If you aren't investing in data and ops, you don't have a mature program, you're less likely to be successful. You're probably just throwing content out there and hoping for the best.
Yep. That is true.
That is true. Do we want to talk a little bit about, there's a section here at the end that talks about the future. Mm-hmm. And we talk about AI. Do we want to move to the future or do we have any more painful memories of the past to dredge up?
Look ahead.
We've talked a lot about we've gone through. Let's talk about the future. Let's get into AI and the impact of AI. We're all talking about that and we're trying to implement it. Well, let's break into it. How should we start to boil this ocean? Because there's a lot. I think one of the things that I would say about how the report came out with AI is you're really thinking about, folks are thinking about the right areas, in my opinion. If I looked at the slide talking about the use case plans, the things that resonate with me and I see, and I'm going to caveat this by saying I'm talking to a number of people who are being kind of more forced to use AI every day and a methodology around it. And it's been mixed, but what this report does is validates the things that do work and things that I've seen too, and I've used it for accelerating that content creation, 73%, right? That's pretty significant. And the way that it works is, you know, now I don't have a blank piece of paper. I can put some, you know, stick some things out there, work a little bit through it, go, oh my gosh, yeah. And I'm moving so much faster and I get some good results. Personalizing learning paths was the next one in order, 61%. Data analysis and visualization at 60.
How can we talk about personalized learning paths?
Like, yeah, I figured you wanted. I was baiting you on that. I wanted to see how far you wanted to go down that road. What's your question about it? Because I'm curious too.
I am. Well, it's probably the same question you have. Like, I'm curious how this is being used in the real world because it seems like a cool application, but it also seems like something that requires like a vast volume of content to curate and enough rich user data to be able to personalize again. So like,
right,
Shannon, I'm curious, like, what are you seeing happening in the world around using AI for personalized learning paths?
Seeing in the world, I don't maybe have not seen a lot of how the world is using personalized learning plans. So we'll start there. I think we, you know, if you think about curated experiences, and you had something here, becomes more realistic when you think about the more general serving content based on customer need, right? And I've thought a lot about like, what is automation versus what is AI, right? Because some of what we might refer to as AI is actually just automation, or it's a curation of content. It's not necessarily leveraging AI. So probably like an important distinction. But to learn more about the learner, right? When you think about how Netflix learns about who you are and the things that you like to watch and then makes recommendations, I do think it depends on having more of a course catalog, more content that you can pull from. We might also see, you know, a world where a platform or is learning more about you as a learner and is able to recommend based on an assessment that you took, hey, maybe go back or like reference this bit here. And I think that is like in the near future that we could see something where it is kind of almost coaching you through the process, where I think for a lot of stuff right now, if you did take an assessment and it just tells you which questions you got wrong, and then maybe you can program. I remember doing this with assessments like, hey, go back to module 5. But yeah, if we could actually pull up, hey, maybe watch this video for a refresher. I think we'll see maybe a little bit more of that, but it is something where, yeah, what does personalized learning paths mean to people? And with a lot of AI stuff, I think that's open for interpretation at this point.
Yeah. Okay. So that's interesting. Like, it kind of, in a way, accords with maybe what Dave and I were both thinking, which is like, it's on the horizon. And I think we can kind of clearly see how it would work or could work, but we aren't seeing it widespread just yet. But I like your point about how it could be used, right? Because I think sometimes we think personalization and where our brains go to is it has to be this like super one-to-one Netflix level of sophistication in the algorithm, which like, again, just requires such a volume of data and such a volume of content to get to that level of precision. But there are other use cases that make a ton of sense, right? Like if we know your user persona, mm-hmm, and we have content tagged to that user persona, it's not hard for a learning system to be able to like show and surface that. It's not that hard to be able to do the use case you just said, which is, you know, sort of like adaptive feedback, you know, like tying you back to relevant course content. And yeah, I had written that note that you called out that like, even if we don't get to this whole like full personalized learning path thing, if you take like the broadest view of what that could mean, if it's this idea of using AI to serve learning related content at the point of need for a customer, that is happening already. And in fact, you know, even at Personio, for instance, right now, we're working on a really cool initiative related to being able to dynamically serve help content from across all of our Voyage by Personio properties. So that's the help center, the community, the academy, et cetera, using more of an AI chat like interface. That's possible. That exists. We're living in that world and it works pretty well. So like that I wouldn't be so surprised to see, like, that's where people think that they're going to make investments, but like, don't want to overstate this whole, like we're not at the point yet where we're going to like wake up and have like the robot butler come to us and like suggest,
oh,
you know,
really?
Plan
come
for
on,
the day,
please.
Right?
Yeah.
You know, I want to circle back and like specify the or state the other ones out loud and then maybe come back to this. But so what we were talking about, that was number two, personalizing learning plans.
Yeah.
Then
do you want to say number one again?
Number one again was accelerating content. And that's where, oh my gosh, it works. So it ChatGPT helps a lot. It isn't perfect.
Well, but not even like, yeah, there's ChatGPT, which you can use for like planning and research and like, you know, helping you develop a course outline and all that. Sorry, Dave, I just interrupted you, but now I get to finish the thought, right? Like, it's also, there are tools now that can take your, like, you can do a click path, right? In your app.
Yes.
And it will record the click path using a browser plugin. And from that, it will dynamically create not just documentation where it'll then like write what it thinks you just did. It'll write those instructions, but it'll also turn that into video.
Mm-hmm. And you're talking about like the Clouseau and Vidiates of the world.
Right, exactly. So like this technology exists, like it can be used. People are using it. So like when I think about accelerating content creation, I think about that, right? Like it's this whole like, it's yes! way easier now. It's way quicker to create that kind of like point and click stepwise instructional content so that we can focus our time as instructional designers and as educators on the stuff that actually requires a higher level of sophistication, rather than just writing all this like step point and click stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's super cool.
Mm-hmm.
And it's super efficient. And you think about it, you know, I'm going to talk over you now, but one of the things
you
that
can't,
I've
seen, I stopped talking.
Yeah. Good. Thank you. Well, no, you didn't. You just talked. Anyway, I've been seeing and interacting with businesses, that are saying, this is the only concern I have. Look at these use cases. In the other three were assessment creation, transcription and translation, and more efficiently planning content. None of these are saying, I'm going to use AI to do everything, to your point you were talking about before. What I am seeing is just this vast treasure trove of new tool sets. For example, I may be working with a client, English is not their primary language. Now I can say, well, let's use Grammarly and let's use all this other stuff to emphasize what tone and voice you're using in the content. And now you've got an assist to help a team that has the subject matter expertise right here, but getting it on paper might take a little bit of a lift, right? Or now we want to see the output of things, or we've got to translate to seven different languages and we want that to be efficient. And how do we do that? So those from a toolkit, this is amazing. The caveat and the thing that I'm trying to encourage leaders that I talk to, there's some leaders out there think there's going to be a magical AI teach us everything kind of tool and are actively moving that way and away from somewhat working with strategic resources that will subsume all of this and help say, well, you can use AI here. Next year, it might be different. The year after, it might be even more different. But we have to imbue the humanness in that or it's going to get away from us.
Yeah. So, Shannon, we got to let you go in a moment. But before we wrap up the show, like, first of all, thank you for helping us really dive into this report and take us behind the scenes. And I think, like, for anyone who's going to go read the report after this, which is all of you, because mm-hmm. we didn't get into nearly all of the great content in here. Usually we avoid giving too many like spoilers or going into the whole report just because like we don't want to like prevent people from reading it themselves. This time I think there's like enough in this report that everyone should just go read it anyway. But Shannon, like before you hop off, what else would you like people to know about the report and where can they find it?
Okay. So you can find the report on Intellum's website. It's under resources and research reports, and you'll find it there. Yeah. And I just think use it. It's agnostic, right? It's not about, right? A lot of these total economic impact reports are about a specific platform. Mm-hmm. You don't have to be using our platform to use this data as part of your business case. So that was, I think, a big thing for me. I think for Intellum was to be able to have something that was applicable and useful to everybody. So please feel free to go ahead, pull that. Please do cite the paper. It's also not, I think Forrester has rules around like, it's not a Forrester study. It's like commissioned by Intellum. You have to say all these things.
Okay.
They have on it. But yeah. But hopefully it's helpful for folks making their case.
Yeah. It's a great report. We really appreciate it. All right, Shannon, once again, thanks for being a good friend of us and of the community and the network of customer education folks. And everybody, if you want to learn more, we have a podcast website at just customer.education, where you can find our show notes and a lot of other material. And we're also part of the customer education community, where you can connect with, learn from, and share your ideas with your peers and leaders who are making a difference. You can find us all on LinkedIn. Anything else we want to say? Special thanks to Alan Coda for our amazing theme music. Adam, you want to take us out?
Yep. Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Shannon. Give us a 5-star review wherever you can rate it. And thanks for joining us. Go out and educate, experiment, and find your people.
Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, everyone.
Bye, everybody.